Members, we're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. And Representative Fenton, you want to move the minutes for January 25th?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved.
Representative Fenton moves the minutes for January 25th, 2017. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. Members, we ran late yesterday, so we are going to start with the Council on Latino Affairs. And sorry.
Going to need a plug in?
Yeah, welcome, Mr. Jimenez. And I understand you brought your family with today.
Going to spend some time with them today. And
we appreciate
with all of us today.
Yes. But I have to tell you, this is considered cruel punishment to your child, making him come to a State Government Finance Committee hearing.
Yes.
Some days they will bring this up to you, and you will rue the day. So,
my wife wants to make sure that I am working as much as I am working. So.
Smart wife. Very good. Well, welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name when you're ready. If she gets restless, I'm happy to hold her, too. Maybe while you're getting set up, too, I should have Ms. Roberts, if you can go through the spreadsheets you provided for us, too, just briefly.
Madam Chair, members, again, there are two reports that have been generated from the MMB systems. The first one is the object code report that you've seen for other agencies. That's entitled BPAS Expenditures by Appropriation, November Base. And then the second one is a page that this was combined. I combined this for all four councils instead of printing on four different sheets of paper, but it's just the legal authority for their spending items.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. And are you ready to go, Mr. Jimenez?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Henry Jimenez. I'm the new executive director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. It's been a year, so I don't know if you can still consider me new, but it's been a year. But I do want to bring to your attention this folder that we prepared for you. So a lot of the slides are in color, so especially the graphs that we created, it would be easier to read if you read them in the different colors that we have. On the left side, you'll find the legislative areas of focus for our agency, and as well as our legislative report. And on the right side, you will find this sheet that is specific to your individual districts. This is only for your individual district, so you will find specific Latino information about your district. And I would be happy to run this by you at individual time, but this is the type of graphs and data you can expect from our council moving forward.
Great, thank you.
There's also a copy of the slides that you would like to follow. Again, I want to thank the committee. This is the first time that our agency gets to present to this body since our restructuring, so I'm really excited to tell you a little bit about how different we are from an agency a year and a half ago. Our mandate statute is 15.0145, which is the same as the other two ethnic councils. Our agency is mandated to advise and inform the governor's office and the state legislature on matters of importance to the Latino community. And if I could emphasize something, is that everything that happens in this body is important to the Latino community, every single bill. The reason being is that Latinos are also Minnesotans. So obviously all bills will be impacting our Latino community. But like other communities, there's some bills that impact the Latino community a little bit more. And so we've been trying to focus our attention to those particular bills that might be impacting the community. Our council is made up of 15 board members. 11 are community members who are appointed by the governor's office. And they come from the 8 congressional districts and 3 at large. The 4 legislative members are 2 from the House and 2 from the Senate, 2 Republicans and 2 Democrats. And I want to make sure that folks understand that when I mean this is a new agency, even our council membership changed. In the last year, we've had 7 new appointed members out of those 11 community members. So when I say that the direction of this council has changed, it has changed. And then in that time, we have transitioned from the staff that we had that I inherited to a completely new staff. We've hired 3 legislative and policy liaisons, and I'll explain a little bit more why they are the legislative liaisons and policy liaisons. So our team came together in October of 22nd of 2016. So we've been together for less than 90 days. This is the organizational chart that we had when I inherited the council. You have an executive director, an office administrator or office manager, a legislative liaison, which was a part-time position, and then a community liaison, which I will say is very important, that was focused in Rochester area. This person was full-time in Rochester. And as much as I think that's important for us too, you know, we have to be creative with the resources that we have. And the way we interpreted the mandate is that we need to focus on the legislative and policy process. And that's where we've dedicated all of our time moving forward. This is the new graph of what our council looks like now. Rosa Tok, Violeta Hernandez, and Erica Mankanki are our new legislative and policy liaisons. As you can see, one of them is a temporary position. And on the far right, you'll see that the office and administrative position hasn't been filled, and it won't be filled because that's duties that I have taken on and that we have spread. We're trying to be lean and be as good as we can with what we have, and we don't believe that having an office manager, although we would love to have that support, is where we would want to focus our resources. We want to focus all our resources here, talking to you, advising you as much as we can on as many bills as we can throughout the session and on policy once we're out of session. Because our job doesn't end once bills become law. Our work, I would say, gets even tougher once that happens because we need to make sure that the legislative intent and the intent of the people are really carried forward in the policy-making process. So as you can see, what we have right now is an example of what we could have and what I think is a working ethnic council. I really strongly believe that if we could afford to have the 4 of us stay on, this is how they would work. And we have supplemented additional work by bringing in student workers or interns or fellows, as you might call them, to also supplement the additional work or research that we might need. So since this, we've updated it to 2 more interns. So now we have 3 staff and 3 interns that are working under them as well to support those research. But again, those are temporary. We're only able to afford this because of the lack of staff we had. At one point, I was a one-person show for months last year. So I saved that money to give you an example of what it would look like if we could afford to have the ethnic councils for them to look like what they look not like now. that's a lot to say. Our historical spending, as you can see, it's pretty much been the same. If you look at the green, that green indicates funds that came from the Bremer a Bremer grant, as well as the Minnesota Historical Center. So those were based on those grants. We don't have those grants as of, you know, 2013. But I could tell you one thing. I strongly believe that we cannot just depend on state money or the people's money. We need to start diversifying how many places or places that we're bringing money from. And I do want to dedicate time to being creative in that sense if we to supplement our work. It can't just be state money. And if you look at the right, when you're a small agency, these graphs look pretty intense because 84% of our budget goes to compensation. And that makes it sound like we have a bunch of folks, but the reality is that we're averaging, you know, 2 to 3 people, 4 people working for us. So that's the bulk of our budget. And operating expenses is 16%. And then the council received $772,000 or $386,000 per fiscal year in the last biennium. And with those numbers, we would not be able to keep what I'm showing you as the example that we can be now As I mentioned before, one of our staff is a temporary position. We're hoping that you like what you're seeing this session from us and are allowing us to maintain what we have as of now. Something important to note is that there's 270,000 Latinos that live in the state of Minnesota, which is about 6% of the total population. If you look at this graph, you'll look that the majority are obviously in Hennepin County and Ramsey County, but it's important to note that one-third of our Latino population lives in greater Minnesota. One-third. And if you were to look at the map of Minnesota, the concentration of Latinos looks like an L, mostly on the west part of the state with a fat bottom on the southern part of the state. And so a lot of our outreach efforts has been dedicated to those areas. Last year, I alone went to 46 community events or meetings where I presented what our council does, and 27 of those was specifically on our legislative work. And we hope to do more of that now that I have a team. So it's not by myself, but mostly, again, in the southern part of the state. One thing to note as well is that out of those 270,000 Latinos, 90% of Latinos under the age of 18 are native-born, just like myself. We know nothing else but this country or that, and particularly this state. So the majority of Latinos are born in this state. And the median age for Latinos is 24 in comparison to 38 years old for the rest of the state. So we're a very young population. One of the issues that I found was that we didn't have a focus. And this is something that I've been hearing from a lot of legislators last year and even this year. You need a focus. And as much as I would like to take over every single issue, we can't. We have four people, and we're focusing each person in four areas. And those are education, economic development, healthcare. And this one is kind of a tricky one, but it's either human rights or immigration. We understand that immigration is a federal issue, but it still affects a lot of our population at the state level. So we just want to make sure we're able to present information to legislators on how bills impact the Latino community on those four areas. Last year we tracked many bills, but some that we had either we testified or presented a position statement or spoke to the author or legislators about a particular bill, it was 39 bills. And again, I want to remind you, for the most part, that was just me, with the support of one other staff. I know that we're going to be able to do more than that. And if we don't, it's going to be even more significant because we're going to be able to spend a lot more time on a particular bill with a particular author or the legislator that's interested in us providing information. And it could be in a position or in support. We're interested to making sure that every legislator can contact us no matter what the bill is. We will provide every legislator the same information we've done to anybody that asks for this. And I just want to make clear that that is our role here. In these bills, we wanted to expand culturally tailored programs that address employment, increase graduation incentive programs, disaggregate student data, increase access to affordable food in greater Minnesota, and those we succeeded in all four of those areas, and I'm really proud of that. As you can see, this first graph, Latinos are an integral part of Minnesota's economy and workforce. But disparities still prevail in our population. We have the highest labor rate participation of 75%, which is higher than any other group in the state of Minnesota. When you compare it to the white population at 70%, the Asian population at 70% as well, we're higher than that. We're working. However, as you can see, the median household income is $42,000 in comparison to $65,000 and $67,000. So there's not a problem about people not working. The problem is that they're working at low wages or getting paid a lot less. And, you know, we've made some connections to graduation rates as well. Folks are going to the labor force before graduating, and that's something that we need to address as well. This is the percentage of Latinos who are uninsured. It's 26%, which is the highest percentage. The last slide was a good slide. This slide is a bad slide. We don't want to be a high number of uninsured. And we want to address this, you know, and I think we have some ideas and proposals, hopefully either this session or next session, that we could help the state make sure that more Latinos are insured. Population with a high school degree or higher is, you know, if you're over 25 years old, only 65% of Latinos have a high school degree. We also know that 66% of Latinos have a on-time high school graduation rate, which is one of the worst in the country, and that's not a percentage that we are happy about, but again, we're ready to work with the legislature and coming up with research and proposals that could help increase these numbers. This is our new team. Again, one of us will not be here next session if we don't get help from you guys. We'd love to be able to keep this team. As you can see, all those charts that we showed you, all these graphs that we're showing you, you can get used to that. That's what's going to be coming from our agency, making sure that we provide you with information that goes out to our communities and to you so that you're able to make those decisions that are best for your constituents. And again, we have tailored them to your own district. Again, the first one, the first page I showed you. So I'm excited to start doing more of that. Trust me, we're already really busy, but I would love to get more requests from legislators on what they need from us. That's all I have for now.
Okay. Yeah. We have a list.
I'm ready.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Jimenez, for your testimony. I assume that it looks like you did some significant restructuring, and there must have been some transitional costs to make that happen. How did you manage that, those costs?
Mr. Jimenez.
Working 80 hours a week for the last 10 months. You know, when you can't... when you inherit an $18,500 deficit because it costs money to transition the former executive director and other needs, you have to get creative, because I'm not going to come back and ask you for money. Or it's, you know, the money has already been allocated. We were on our second year of the biennium. And so one thing I did was not rehire the office manager, and I took on those duties. And when I say I worked 80 hours, my wife is right there. You can ask her. unfortunately, it was during a time where my daughter was born, so I had a hard time. But I can tell you that I love this state and I love what I do. And I hope that you can see that the transition has paid off, that we are moving forward. I still feel like we're a pretty lean machine, you know, for what we have and what we're providing. And again, we're hoping that we can keep what we can have now, because I'm only able to show you what we can possibly be because I didn't hire people for an entire year. And I was able to finally bring in folks in October to show you for at least the next 7 months what we can do. And hopefully we have already shown you that we can do a lot more.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at I can appreciate your struggle, yeah. And as I look at the numbers here, I'm looking at the centralized IT services, and that's chewing up over 20% of your budget. And from what I'm looking at here, from fiscal year 15 to 19, if you look at the bienniums, it's up like five times. Is there something special that you needed, or because I agree that you need more personnel help maybe than...
Yeah, and thank you, Representative, Madam Chair. And actually, I believe that's a question that Representative Nash asked the other ethnic councils. What I can tell you is that the minute rates, I have no control over that. You know, minute puts those rates, and that's what we have to pay. But what I believe is that those rates have increased because they're adding on, I believe, cybersecurity and the cost of hardware. So instead of us having to buy a new computer every, you know, 5 years or whenever we're able to afford to buy new computers, it's already included in that rate. I know that there's more, and I'm sure Minute can explain it better to you. I've already requested for them to give me something in writing that I can provide to you. Unfortunately, they didn't have it by 1 o'clock today, but I trust me, I've already given them a call yesterday and today, and we should have that for you as soon as possible.
And Mr. Jimenez, we do have Mr. Eichten here, and he can maybe shed some light. And Mr. Eichten, just so you know, I mean, this is a common theme here in each of the agencies. So you heard Representative Vogel's question. Can you help us understand why so much?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. For the record, John Eichten, Legislative Director for Minnesota IT Services. Representative Vogel, you know, I came prepared to speak to the change from the current biennium to the next biennium. I don't know what drivers may have increased IT costs for the council from the 14-15 to the 16-17. We can get back to you on that. I know there was some website development work that occurred in the 16-17 biennium, but in terms of the 16-17 to 18-19, the base IT budget for the agency was $11,000 per year. That increase is increasing in the 18-19 biennium to $19,000 per year, so an $8,000 per year increase. $6,000 of that is for network and telecom services, so we want to get the council onto the state network where we can automatically patch, we can automatically do updates. This is the cybersecurity component that the director is speaking to. So that's a $6,000 a year impact, but that does include the replacement costs for things like network gear, routers, switches. Then there's a $1,000 a year increase for workstation support. So this would be like your laptops, your desktops, the ongoing support of those, and that would also include the refresh cycle that the director spoke of. So a laptop, desktop would get replaced. I believe it is a it's either a 4 or a 6 year cycle for that. There are tiered rates for that, so an agency can choose to replace sooner if they want, but they're going to pay a higher yearly rate. And then the last $1,000 is for Microsoft licensing. That was the result of the renegotiations with Microsoft for things like Office, Word. We use the cloud Office 365 offering for email. So there's going to be a licensing increase of $1,000 a year there. And Madam Chair, I know you're seeing these kind of increases generally for a lot of the small agencies, boards, councils, commissions. It's largely attributable to we're trying to bring everyone in the executive branch up to a standard service level. We want to have people on a standard refresh cycle. That's good for business efficiency. That's good in terms of security. And it's good of ensuring that ultimately we get to a place where we can fully harness the economy of scale that comes from operating as one consolidated IT shop instead of approaching things, you know, separately within individual agency silos. So happy to answer any questions.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I guess the concern I have is looking at an agency like this and knowing their struggles and how maybe more efficiency could be, or whatever, because you're chewing up 20% of their non-personnel expense, and it just makes it hard for people to operate in an environment. And I realize that there's overhead that comes into this that might have been there before, but you know, it does seem to be a reoccurring theme as I've looked over these numbers and wondering if there can't be something done to assist them, because, like I said, it's not. Granted, it's necessary, but it's not always, it's not furthering the cause.
Yes. We recognize, especially for the agencies that are small, that have limited budgets, tight budgets, that it is it's a significant increase for them, and I think that's why you're going to see IT service costs increase baked into some of the operating increases that are being moved forward by the in the governor's budget recommendations. Again, we know it's not easy, but we think it's very important.
Representative Uglum, to this point? Or?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Director, I'd just like to follow up a little bit on Representative Vogel's line of questioning. The numbers here are relatively small, but the numbers on some of the other agencies are actually quite high, and the percentages are quite high across the board. Do you ever have any agency head question these costs, and how do we know that what you're providing them is competitive in the marketplace?
Mr. Eichten.
Madam Chair, members, we certainly have them question the costs. And a lot of times what's difficult is that the numbers reflect some level of rate increases from the base cost of IT goes up with vendor contracts and the like. It also includes consumption increases. So they choose to build a new website, to budget for operations and maintenance on a system that's been developed and is now going to go live. So when you look at those numbers, you see them all sort of bundled and totaled together. And so if there are specific agencies you'd like us to dive in, do a breakout on, we're in the midst of that for the human rights discussion that occurred yesterday with that office. And, you know, in that case, they're opening a new office in St. Cloud, I believe it is. And they're going to put staff there. That means they need computers. They need a secure Internet connection. And there's going to be an increase in the cost. So we certainly, you know, it's our job to explain to our business partners what they're getting for the increase in these costs. I know you had a second question. I'm sorry.
Yes, Madam
Chair. Representative Ugo.
Just one other follow-up. Director, what do you charge these agencies for your overhead or burden?
Okay.
Madam Chair, this is...
In a percent.
You know, I don't have the percent. I can get the percent for you, but I will say there's a significant change this year in terms of overhead costs. So what we're doing is our entire rate package, and I can return for a moment to your other question was, how do you know you're competitive? So 6 months ago, we said we want to benchmark ourselves against all the other states in the private sector. So we went out, we hired a vendor to come in, look at the rates for all of our services, and compare us. We're just getting those results back right now. We're asking them to clarify exactly how they arrived at them. But what they show, the last I saw, was that we are at or better than 84% of those states and private sector providers that we compared with. So we feel we're happy about the results that we've seen so far. But in terms of overhead, we moved overhead, so HR, finance, the things that all of the state consumes, we moved that out of the rate package, and we're now assessing it on a per-employee with a per-employee metric. And this is because there were some agencies that consumed a whole lot of services from the rate package and had very little IT spend locally within their individual agency. The councils would be a good example of that. Most of their IT was bought from the central minute shop. You have other agencies like a Department of Revenue that have a significant IT spend at their local agency and were buying very little of the enterprise rate services relatively. So agencies like the council were shouldering an unfair portion of the overhead costs. So we moved that out of the package. We put it as a per-employee charge. So per-employee is a much better predictor of how much of the HR, how much of the finance costs you should have to bear, because after consolidation, we do HR and finance for the entire executive branch, regardless of what local versus enterprise spend that particular agency has. So we felt this was more fair. We also felt that we knew it would reduce the impact of any rate increases on the small boards, councils, and commissions that consume a relatively high share of enterprise services. I hope that makes sense. I know it's a lot.
Madam Chair, one follow-up. It would be nice if you would share that information on your competitiveness with this committee, and then even so, you're still 20% of this poor gentleman's budget here. So thank you.
Mr. Eichten, I'd be interested in the study that you did from state to state, private and public sector.
Yeah.
Did you include the overhead costs in that comparison?
Madam Chair, I believe that it would be of our 18-19 rates, the rates that we're moving into come July. So it would not include the overhead costs because we moved that out of the rate package. But I can confirm it's possible we use the rates of 16-17. I don't know, but I would hope that we use the rates of the upcoming biennium. It would be more relevant.
And Mr. Eichten, when you were looking at the other states in both public and private sector, do you know if they had their overhead costs included?
Madam Chair, I don't know that, but I can find out.
Okay. I think that would be helpful, and I'd like to see the study that you did as well.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Full report, please. And I am very concerned about the overall cost. I think the intent of having this centralized was to have some cost savings from it. So when you come back before the full committee, I'm going to be looking for when will we actually achieve cost savings. And I'd also like to see a historical perspective for each of the agencies of what did they pay prior to the change in law to what they're paying now. And so with that, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director Jimenez. Appreciate your great presentation. In preparation for this, I went back and took a look at the information that I had on your council from last biennium, and what I've seen today and what I've heard is just extremely impressive, especially with an exclamation point and a footnote that you were a one-man show for a pretty significant period of time. I just brought a copy of the last biennium's booklet that I got. It was very, very expensive, no doubt, relative to the frugal manner in which you presented your data. And not to mention, you have taken a look very closely at the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor and the findings. And the overall finding, well, on the very, very first page, you know, little evidence that the state's four minority councils have been effective advisors or liaison to the state policymakers. And we've already seen right here with your agency, including a report that each of one of us has received specific to our constituencies and districts. So just really, really pleased about that. You've already answered some of my questions, but I'm wondering if you wouldn't want to speak any further to either one of the findings that I've challenged the other councils, specifically having done a poor job of specifying objectives and outcomes, quantifying and the like. And then secondly, with regard to the outreach that you've done in communities, I heard you say that, you know, again, you're the only one that, you know, attended 46 events in your community. Yeah. But if you have anything to add to share with our group, I would appreciate that.
Yeah. Mr. Jimenez.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, thank you for that question. I can tell you that in 2014 when that report came out, I was an executive director at a nonprofit. And I read that as a civilian, and I was just amazed at, you know, reading the what the findings were. I mean, anybody leading any organization should have those things figured out within months, you know, of starting an organization. So I can tell you that I took that very seriously with our new council members, and we completely used the OLA report as one of our guiding principles of what we were going to do, and making sure that we're on point of everything that was mentioned there. And I can tell you 100% I feel that if we were to get audited again, they would tell you exactly that we have made sure to listen to what the OLA report said. I've met with the OLA office multiple times last year for that purpose. So I'm really happy that you can see that. And when you mentioned being frugal, that was another area that I looked at. The first thing I looked was, you know, okay, how can we reduce our costs in every place? And when I noticed that working through the state, I realized that there's some areas that I have no control, like our IT services. And I understand where they came from with those costs, but everywhere else that I can make some changes, I did. And I can tell you that I've saved money in every place that we could. I feel very confident about that. I also would like to say that the reason we also got there is I have to thank, and I know that he's coming up, but Greg Hubinger from the LCC has been just tremendous help to me and always opened his doors throughout the year to help me with this process. And the smart agencies, they're the reasons why our finances are up to par, because they are the ones that are able to take care of that. So I just want to give a shout-out to the LCC and the smart agency.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I have an unrelated question as well. I don't need a follow-up on that, my previous question, but it is with regard to page 5, the second slide with regard to health care. And I'm assuming that is, in fact, maybe I've answered my own question. No, I'm wondering if it is just health care. I see that your slide specifies just uninsured. And I'm wondering if that is in its entirety is health care.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, before I answer, can I just reintroduce our board chair? He was here yesterday, but I'm glad to have him here.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Uriel Perez Espinosa, U-R-I-E-L for the record, P as in Paul, E-R-E-Z. Espinosa, Espinoza, and I thank you for letting me be here, and just want to briefly say that we went through difficult times in 2014. I've been there for 2 years. I came when the council was trying to be dismantled. We had the changes. Last year we got a little progress, and 2016 was the first year that we had the executive director working on fiscal responsibility, and we were focusing on what the OLA report was asking us to do, and we are ready and eager to move forward with the new staff on the challenges that we were facing and ready to comply with our duties to advise not just the governor, but you guys, and be liaisoned with the community. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Menes, to your question.
And can you remind me of the question?
Yes. And so, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Page 5, the second slide, with regard to the percentage of the population that is uninsured,
yes.
Is this in its entirety health care, or are there other components there?
Yes. Mr. Menes.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's specifically on health care.
Mm-hmm. And thank you, Madam Chair. That's it.
And I just have one last question, and we do need to get on to the other folks that we have here today.
Yeah.
So a common question that I have is asking, do you see it as part of your role to address concerns for discrimination, to do education on that? Is that something that you take as part of your responsibilities as a council?
Madam Chair, great question. I know you asked that to the other council members. What I can tell you is that if there's an opportunity for us to refer those type of needs from our community, we refer them to the Human Rights Department. I see that as their responsibility to do so. I strongly believe that our mandate states that we are to advise and inform the governor's office and state legislature on matters important to our Latino community. And that question to me seems like, yes, we've been involved with some of our community members in St. Cloud and other parts of the state that have had some maybe human rights violations or discrimination, but you know, we're not investigators. The Human Rights Department is, and I think we need to utilize what we already have, and we've made sure to connect them to the Human Rights Department when that occurs.
Do you see it as your responsibility to educate on discrimination?
Yeah, I would say that we're constantly communicating with our community. Like I mentioned, we do face-to-face, but going to community events and doing that, social media and emails, we do educate on the process of the legislative and policymaking process, and if when there's instances like these, we will educate them on other issues. But for me to tell you that that was my sole responsibility last year, I would say that was not. No.
Okay. Yeah. Last question, Representative Omar, and then we need to get on.
I do apologize, Madam Chair. Thank you. I want to echo what a lot of the legislators and, have said about your work. It's commendable. And so thank you so much for coming and giving an excellent presentation. I wanted to know, and maybe this was information that – this might be information that other committee members might have – but I'm interested in knowing how is it that we allocate the resources, or how is it decided how much money each council gets? If you know what that ratio is based on.
Actually, Mr. Jimenez, I think that's a better question for Ms. Roberts. I mean, that's part of our responsibility as a committee. So we have all of the budgets for all the different minority councils, as well as all the other agencies that have come before us. So we're the ones that set what the budget is,
yeah.
And the agencies themselves, the councils included, come forward with their own budget proposal. You'll have seen, of course, the governor's budget proposal, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all part of the process.
And we have a ratio set.
Say it again?
We have a ratio set for which council gets what amount.
What's the history on that, Ms. Roberts? Do you have...
Madam Chair, I can just tell you quickly, for example, what the base is for each council. For the Minnesotans of African Heritage Council, it's $401,000 per year. For the Latino Affairs Council, it's $386,000 a year. For the Asian Pacific Minnesotans Council, it's $364,000 a year. And then for the Council on Indian Affairs, it's $576,000 per year. And I believe just some of the history is that for the Indian Affairs Council, they do have a higher a level of funding, and part of that is because of their additional duties that they have under some of the federal laws.
Mm-hmm. Representative Omar.
Thank you. I was, I think, more, I didn't know how much each council gets. Well, I was more interested in what's that decision based on? Is it based on population size? Is it based on productivity? You know, like, how is that based on?
Well, from a historical perspective, Ms. Roberts, do you know how it got started? You said the Indian Affairs Council had it because of their additional duties. Do you know how it originally started, what the ratio is?
Madam Chair, I don't, but I can try to find out.
And typically, you know, up to this point, what we traditionally have done is each council gets a percentage of what their base is. And so it's not different. So if their base started off higher, like the, and I'm going to forget the new name now, African Heritage Council, has 401. I think you said the Asian had, 386. That's based upon kind of how they got their start. But we can maybe dig into that more. I'm sure that Ms. Roberts and Mr. Gehring can give us greater historical perspective on that and how it started that way in the first place.
Yeah, I would appreciate that. I think we should reevaluate and look at and probably incentivize people who are doing exceptional work and maybe not so much for others who are not.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. And with that, thank you for coming today. Appreciate you being flexible and changing your plans, especially when your family's in the audience. So she did great, by the way. Really good baby.
For the record, her name is Lucia Loretta Jimenez.
Lucia. Ah, beautiful name. Love it. Thanks, guys. All right. With that, we're going to have Campaign Finance Board come next, please. Mr. Sigurdsson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director for the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I took that position on September 1st of 2016.
And Mr. Sigurdsson, I'm going to ask you to really speak into the microphone and speak loudly. We have some white noise that really makes it difficult for us to hear.
Yes, ma'am. I'll certainly try. I realize that the time of the committee is limited here, so my background information is going to be fairly quick, and then get directly to a couple of projects that the board is doing, and then allow you to, obviously the questions that you may have. The board is an independent agency. Although the governor provides our budget with his overall budget proposal, we are not part of the governor's office and not report to the governor's office. The board consists of 6 members, no more than half may be with any particular political party. The State Government Policy and Elections Committee will have 4 members of the board up for it for confirmation this year, as will the Senate. The board has a staff of 8 full-time positions and 2 part-time positions. Our FTE is approximately 9.2. Our mission is to promote public confidence in state government decision-making, and that's through providing information disclosure on the candidates, lobbyists, public officials who provide reports and register with the board. There are 3 major programs, all of which affect members of this committee: the Campaign Finance Program, the Lobbying Program, and the Economic Interest Statement Program. The Campaign Finance Program is limited to state-level offices and committees. We provide registration and support for 649 candidates, 319 political party units, 48 independent expenditure committees, which have rather different financing than other types of committees, and then 340 regular political committees, which most people refer to as PACs. Our major disclosure period is coming up on the 31st, and you want to remind your treasurer where you have the 2016 year-end reports, and we're going to be receiving almost 1,400 reports on that particular day. And then the day after the end of the filing period, they're all available on our website for public disclosure. We also provide free support to all treasurers through our software. That software is, again, free. We have a dedicated help desk person for that position or for that support as well. We provide treasurer training, including our first efforts to try to get online training available for committees. We realize that for greater Minnesota, it's very difficult to come down to the board offices in St. Paul to attend training or to attend our computer lab training. So we have about 15, I believe, quick videos on using the software that are about 2 to 3 minutes long that the treasurers can get a quick answer on a particular issue. And then we have five much longer videos, about 20 minutes long, on compliance training, looking at more of the issues, not on using the software, but rather on issues on contributions, expenditures, things like that. And those are all indexed so that they don't have to wade through the entire video, online video. They can go directly to a particular area that they find of interest or they have a question on. Again, trying to move, try to leverage technology so that we can provide better support for the treasurers who are most often volunteers and certainly who are trying to do their best and are dealing with a complicated statute. We do conduct investigations in response to complaints and to documents filed with the board. We provide the public subsidy program. In 2016, we paid out a little over $2,162,000 to 339 legislative candidates, which is 90% of the legislative candidates who were on the general election ballot. Switching to the lobbying program, we have about 1,450 lobbyists who are registered with the board. They represent about 1,460 principals, a principal being an association or corporation who hires and is represented by a lobbyist. The lobbying that is covered by the program that the board administers is not statewide. It deals with the legislature. It deals with administrative rulemaking process. It deals with the Public Utilities Commission. And it does deal with some entities within the seven-county metro area, all seven counties in any city with a population of over 50,000. Trying to influence the official action of any of those entities is a lobbying effort that requires registration and reporting to the board. We did have about 1,360 reports filed in mid-January for 2016. We get the principal reports, which is the overall spending on a lobbying year in March. But I can tell you that in 2015, the total lobbying spending in Minnesota was over $69 million. So there is quite a bit of funding that we're tracking for the reports and, again, providing public information on that program. And then lastly, in the lobbying program, we do administer and enforce the gift prohibition between public officials and lobbyists and lobbyist principals. Economic interest statements, we do an annual certification for all public officials. You're undoubtedly aware that you're public officials and you need to certify by the end of the month, but in truth, there's a lot of public officials. There's 2,637 currently, and that number is increasing as we bring in judges and county commissioners. All county commissioners are now public officials who file with the board, and after 2018, all judges will also be filing a statement with the board as well. And again, those are all available on our website. Moving beyond those, that quick outline of our functions, we do have two major projects, which I know that in the past the legislature has been interested in. We have rolled out our new website, which was, for us, a major undertaking. We believe the website is, in fact, how we're going to get information to the public in the future. Paper reports are simply not distributed in a way that is sufficient. Our new website is in soft release. By that I mean you can still break it. But we have finished the major functions. We are building on additional pages as we go, and we're maintaining our legacy site. In fact, if you file online, you'll still be going to the legacy site. But we intend to switch over to the new site sometime in late spring, early summer, once we have it kind of finished up here. That so far has cost $260,000 to date, and we can cover the funding of that mechanism or that project a little bit later on. We are looking at a couple of other functions that we'd like to add on if we're able to, and that is to add online registration for both the lobbying and campaign finance programs onto the website. The other issue, which you were provided as a separate document, is that the board, although it has no legislative recommendations this year, is looking at two different rulemaking documents that's outlined in this document, which I believe you were provided. One of those dockets, I feel very confident in saying, as a very much a technical set of rules. It's just bringing rules that are out of date because of legislative changes that they're trying to provide additional information on. For example, there are some rules dealing with disclosure that still reference any expenditure over $100 or any contribution over $100. Well, that provision was in statute increased over $200 four years ago now, and the rules haven't been caught up. So there are a large number of those type of rules which I think are going to be non-controversial and will move fairly quickly. The second set of rules, which we certainly have been encouraging all legislators to be aware of and perhaps send staff to, is admittedly more controversial. It will be looking at areas that may be trying to incorporate advisory opinions dealing with independent expenditures, non-campaign disbursements, and other areas that would be more widely applicable than to the entire regulated community. And so part of the process is, again, moving advisory opinions into administrative rule. This is going to be an opportunity for the public to provide comment as to how that process should occur, how far the board should go. I will say that the board is very aware that this is a sensitive area. There's certainly no interest that I can tell from any board member in trying to provide additional policy here on any of those subjects. But through findings and, again, through the multiple advisory opinions that we've received, sometimes basically on the same topic, it's also clear that the legislator, that the body of statutes dealing with those areas can use some additional support and clarification. We believe that through the administrative rulemaking process, we can then support both the entities that are regulated by those rules and, frankly, make it so that the board has to do less investigations in those areas as well. That process is starting on February 1st when the first meeting will be held. There is a subcommittee that the board has established that has two board members on it. Obviously, staff is providing the legwork. But we always wanted to have board members part of this process so that they can hear directly from anyone who's concerned or who has input on this process and who wishes to make sure that the board is aware of those concerns. Because it's a more contentious area, I doubt that these rules will be finished anytime prior to the fall. But, again, we're trying to get it done prior to the next election year. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm open to any questions you may have.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions briefly on independent expenditures. I wonder if you've completed your preliminary analysis of independent expenditures in 2016, whether you anticipate seeing a rise in that money spent, and then also, what are your thoughts on independent expenditures as it relates to those that are not reported because they're not advocating for a specific candidate or policy? I suspect there's a fair amount of underreporting in that regard. Could you give me your thoughts on that?
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, two things. Until we receive the end-of-the-year report at the end of this month, I won't be able to give you a final number. I did do a preliminary report after the pre-general report, and at that point there was about $16 million in independent expenditures for the House and Senate candidates. I'm trying to recall the ratio. I know that there was more for Senate races, but I'm afraid I don't exactly recall the ratio off the top of my head. I will certainly be providing to the policies committees and to this committee, if there's interest, the final numbers on the independent expenditures that we will receive at the end of the month. To your second question, a little bit of historical information. In 2013, the board did provide a legislative recommendation that looked at the issue of express advocacy, basically saying that what I believe your point to being is that there are lots of expenditures, lots of communications out there that are avoiding using words like vote for, vote against, reelect. And because they avoid those words under the current definition of independent expenditure, they are not independent expenditures if made by an entity that's not already registered with the board. So in other words, if you, as a candidate, put out a piece that didn't say vote for me but otherwise made it clear that it was supporting your candidacy, that's still a campaign expenditure. But if an entity that's not registered with the board does that and avoids, again, those express advocacy terms, that's not an independent expenditure. So the numbers that I'm providing or indicating to you do not include those type of communications. The legislature considered that issue for three consecutive years and in all 3 years decided not to move forward on that. Based on that, the board this year does not have that as a legislative recommendation. Also, I would also say is because when that set of recommendations were made, frankly, only one of the existing six members was sitting on the board, and with four members coming up for confirmation, I think the board just was more comfortable sitting back, getting through that process, having a chance to get used to the positions that they're now being appointed to, and then coming back to that issue to see if there's anything that, any information that can be provided to the legislature on that issue.
Representative Johnson.
No further questions.
And when they are not registered with the board and they make such an expenditure like that, that doesn't count against the candidate, does it?
Madam Chair, no, it does not. It's those type of expenditures are outside of the campaign finance regulations in Chapter 10A.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sundberg, what areas do you feel the legislature could support your agency in a non-financial way?
Mr. Sigerson.
Madam Chair, Representative Fenton, the board did consider the question of whether there was, if this was a point for a change item, in other words, coming with you with a specific recommendation either for additional staff or some other line item that would be specific. And frankly, we decided not to. We believe our staffing is sufficient. We believe that we are administering the programs. You know, I realize that there's sometimes always going to be time delays between when a complaint is filed and when a resolution comes out. But basically, we believe we're able to address the requirements of Chapter 10A, provide good service to both the legislature and to the public on those issues. I think that our concern, you've heard this from other small agencies, but I guess I'll state it as well. If you look at our budget, we are roughly 80%, I'm rounding, but roughly 80% is staff. So a significant cut, it's pretty hard to avoid then reducing staff, and which would then, of course, immediately affect our ability to carry out our functions.
Representative
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Sigerson, do you believe that the legislature passed laws to support your agency's efforts?
Mr. Sigerson.
Madam Chair, Representative Fenton, I'm not 100% sure I understand your question, ma'am. We believe that the statutes that we have certainly are enforceable, and that we're if this relates to the administrative rules, we don't believe that there's any additional policy direction that's required. As with all administrative rules, there are occasions when we believe that the statute can be you know, additional clarification provided as to what the board believes it means. We feel that the statute here, again, there's no legislative recommendations. We're certainly providing support to anyone, any member of the legislature who has questions on how any particular legislation would work relative to Chapter 10A. But at this point, the board doesn't have recommendations that may be different a year from now.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sigerson, do you believe, in terms of rulemaking, do you believe that your agency needs rulemaking?
Mr. Sigerson.
Madam Chair, Representative Fenton, yes, I believe we do. There's two areas that the board is actually directed through statute to make administrative rules. One is for the general provisions of Chapter 10A, and there are, again, a few areas, especially in the non-controversial area, non-controversial docket, which I believe that's what we're doing. But also the statute very specifically says that if the board has an advisory opinion that it believes has wider application, in other words, it would be useful for the entire regulated community, that the regulated community shouldn't have to try to find an advisory opinion. It should be able to find that in administrative rule, and that at that point it would then apply to everybody. That board has been behind on that, and that's what you see here. If you go through, you know, just briefly, if you go through the docket, we don't have any specific language developed yet. We didn't want to do that. The board didn't want to do that until we've heard from the public and the regulated community. But on the areas that we're looking at, you'll see that as you go through them, there's typically at least one and sometimes multiple advisory opinions listed behind a particular topic area. And that, again, reflects the idea that there are members of the regulated community who aren't sure what that statute means and, what's more, want safe harbor or at least further explanation before they take action. So those are areas that the board believes it should be appropriate to move those advisory opinions into administrative rules.
Representative Fenton.
I think there are other questions. So no further questions right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You look familiar.
Yes, sir.
We've had you in government operations and elections. And one of the things that we were looking at and were working on today was helping your efforts to get more electronic filing. I appreciate your working with us to that end, and you found some really pretty good things. And so I think that the legislature has been open to the recommendations and questions and concerns of the board. Having said that, you've made the comment controversial versus non-controversial. When I've been at the legislature, the very first thing I learned down here was physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. to what happens. And so I guess my question becomes, what's controversial to one might not be deemed as controversial to another. How does the board go through and make that determination as to what is and what is not controversial?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think it's based on our experience as an administrative agency. Simply, again, looking at the areas that have advisory opinions on a few areas where there's been findings issued based on, again, trying to provide, enforcing the statutes in terms of what an on-campaign disbursement is or what may be an independent expenditure, what may not be an independent expenditure. The fact that the board had to go to an advisory opinion or to the advisory opinion process or to issue findings indicates that there is some controversy. I would also say that we use that term, and perhaps that was an unfortunate term, although I think accurate, because we expect, in fact, to hear from people on both sides. I think that there will be people who will come forward and hope that the board is pretty aggressive on an area, and we certainly expect to hear from people who think that while perhaps in a rule is necessary, that rule should not be as restrictive as perhaps someone else will suggest. I do think, and just provide this as a background perspective on how I believe staff is at least addressing approaching this process, and I think the board's approach as well, is that the board is very aware that when you do administrative rules, three out of the four things that can happen are not so good. The only good thing that can happen is that you have an administrative rule that, one, is enforceable from an administrative standpoint and which provides guidance and or assistance to the regulated community. That's what we're trying to get to. Bad things that can happen is that the governor's office can veto all administrative rules after you're done with the process, which is a lot of work for no particular benefit. Two, the Office of Administrative Hearing reviews all administrative rules and determines whether you've exceeded your authority or, again, come up with a rule that is outside the bounds of the agency. And then three, relative to the legislature, and this has happened on at least two, maybe three occasions, the board has issued an advisory opinion, and the very next session the legislature passed a statute that said, I'm sorry, you're wrong, this advisory opinion is... this is how we want to do it, and the statute directly contradicted the advisory opinion, which is fine. That's the sort of feedback that is obviously direct, and the board can move forward from there. So we are, again, trying to stay away from issues that are going to not result in the one good thing, which is an administrative rule that helps both the board and the regulated community.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess... one of the things you have background is that you're planning on doing some rulemaking on express advocacy and different things, and there was an amendment dealing with that issue earlier today in the committee that I referenced where I saw you. And I guess the concern that I have is the legislature has wanted to take a slow-go approach on this because when you start talking about speech and free speech, you don't always have to like the speech, but you have to honor people's right to speak. And we saw that in the Citizens United that the Supreme Court ruled constitutionally that those organizations have the right to be able to organize and to communicate in a way that they want. And I know that for some that's, again, that equal and opposite reaction. The Supreme Court ruled one way. Another group of people are seeing that, in this case, the Supreme Court has erred. There may be other decisions where a different group has said, nope, the Supreme Court has erred, and others say, no, the Supreme Court was just spot on this, just absolutely spot on this particular topic. The concern that I have is whenever we try to quell the speech of people, whether they are people who unite for purposes of advocating a position of whatever it may be, or people who band together for the purposes of advancing their labor issues, whatever the case may be, everyone needs to be treated fairly and equally. And there are some disparities that are in the different ways people organize and how they can communicate that and what the reporting requirements would be and the like. And so I don't think that the legislature is being arbitrary or capricious when they say they want to take a slow go on quelling people's freedom of speech, regardless of how they are organized, until we can make sure that everyone who has that right can be on that same playing field. I don't know if there's necessarily a question, but it's more of a philosophical observation, having been on the Operations and Elections Committee ever since I've been here in the legislature and kind of having the opportunity to walk through some of those things. So thank you for your time.
Mr. Sigurdsson, in one concise sentence, can you tell me what do you view the mission of the Campaign Finance Board.
Madam Chair, I believe it's to make the public confident in both the election process for state elected officials and the disclosure of the influences on state elected officials. I realize that wasn't exactly a concise sentence, but I believe there's a belief in the public that they should understand how the election is being conducted. So disclosure on the money that you raise, you being a campaign committee, the money that you raise, where you receive that money, the relative impact on things like independent expenditures on races, all help the public understand how elections are conducted in Minnesota. And then after the election is over, there are the other two programs, lobbying and economic interest, again provide some insight for the public to understand the pressures on you as you make decisions. Who's coming to the legislature? How much are they spending? Which is a relative amount, I realize, but nonetheless, doesn't tell you everything. But how much are they spending to try to influence legislative action? And then, again, the Economic Interest Program is trying to point out if there is any potential conflicts of interest between you as an individual and your personal financial concerns in any decision that you may make. That's, again, to provide public confidence that your actions are because of what you believe philosophically and as what you do as the best for your district, as opposed to eliminating the possibility that you're doing something to benefit yourself personally. So, again, all of this, I believe, ties into the idea of building public confidence in the actions of the legislature and the way elections are conducted and then the way bills are drafted and passed in the state. And I apologize, that was a lot more than one sentence.
Mr. Sigurdsson, how much are you planning to spend on rulemaking? You've got the initial proposal here for 2017. Going beyond that, how much are you planning to spend on rulemaking? So for 2017, what is your spend for rulemaking?
Madam Chair, I believe that the estimate, and I'm sorry I'm not actually seeing it on here, but I believe that the staff estimate is that we're looking about $4,000 to $5,000 for billing from the Office of Administrative Hearings. That's a little bit of a worst-case scenario in that it assumes that we might have to go to a contested case hearing. If there's not a contested case hearing, then I think it would be approximately half that amount to adopt the administrative rules.
So if contested, you're expecting the cost would be $4,000 to $5,000?
Yes, ma'am, and that is an estimate. I don't have that as a estimate from the Office of Administrative Hearings. It's just a staff estimate.
And then going into 2018, what is your rulemaking agenda?
Madam Chair, we have no administrative rules projected for 2018. The last time that the board did administrative rules was 2014, and that was in direct response to a legislative mandate. We were required to adopt administrative rules on how we conduct investigations, which we did within the year after the legislation was passed. Prior to that, to the best of my recollection, the last administrative rules prior to that was maybe 2009, I may be off by year. But in other words, it's not exactly a regular routine. It's something that it's in response. Because we have a small staff, we can't be doing administrative rules. It's a time-consuming process. It's going to consume much of the time of one of my legal analysts in trying to draft rules as we go forward for the public to comment and for the board to consider. It's something that at best we probably do every 4 or 5 years.
Well, Mr. Sigurdsson, I'm a little concerned, and I'll just tell you this. So in the beginning of the month, it was the first weekend after New Year's, and I went to go and enter in my data to try and get my report done for 2016 so I don't have to worry about it when the thick of session was well underway. And I called your office, and they said, well, it's not ready yet, and you aren't going to be able to enter in anything. And for me, from my perspective, I view the Campaign Finance Board as playing that role for disclosure, of playing the role of enforcing the rules that are passed by the legislature for you to enforce. And I'm concerned when I'm looking at the rulemaking docket that it's becoming more of an activist board that I have concerns with, in that how we have public input. Now, when we hold a hearing here at the Capitol, it's a lot more public, more transparent than a rulemaking session with the Campaign Finance Board. And I'm very concerned about making major changes that impact our state that are what I view kind of outside of your purview. And I thought it was interesting that you weren't coming to the legislature for any agenda here at the legislature when these are some of the conversations that we could have here. That being said, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so many of my questions and concerns have just been expressed, starting with Government Operations and Elections Chair O'Driscoll. And so I will look forward to setting up a meeting with you one-on-one so I could go a little deeper. But just in general, I wanted, so the cost of the rulemaking question was answered. I'm wondering what legislation enabled the rulemaking and when.
Mr. Sigurdsson?
Representative, the authority to have administrative rules on those two areas, I'm not sure which year, but basically it's always been there since in the 16 years that I've been with the board. Those two, the authority to make administrative rules have been there for at least 16 years because that's the point at which I joined the agency. So it's been in place, I think, since the board was established.
Representative Pugh. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, you know, I've been a member of the legislature for 4 years, and in my freshman year, the first year, I was just very concerned about what was occurring at the time with regard to rulemaking. And what I learned from drilling down is that, first of all, rules, and I'm certain most everyone here is aware of this, but the rulemaking process and rules have the full force and effect of law. And there are 100 agencies that have rulemaking authority, and my understanding was that it required legislation to, and which I could be wrong, it sounds like I am, but it required legislation to direct rulemaking either the regular process or expedited. So if for clarification, if what I'm hearing, that the agency, the organization, the Campaign Finance Board just has this rulemaking authority, if I could have clarification, and maybe from staff, I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Gehring, can you help us out?
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, so the Campaign Finance Board has a general rulemaking authority. This is Section 10A.02, sub 13, and the authorization in the statute is that the board is authorized to adopt rules to carry out the purposes of this chapter. So there's no specific type of rulemaking that it authorizes, just that whichever rules the board feels is consistent with their mandates under Chapter 10A, they're allowed to adopt rules to that effect. So. And this section, I don't know the exact date this has been adopted, but it's been there for at least 10 years, which is how long I've been here.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Gehring, and, you know, we'll learn something new around here every day, but I'm even more concerned about that now, especially given that we have, you know, I took a look here at the controversial changes as well as the potentially controversial changes. Six of those and two of the controversial changes is deemed by the Campaign Finance Board, and, you know, maybe a little page of the non-controversial, and I'm just really concerned about the impact of this. I have questions about how controversial are some of the advisory opinions anyway, and, you know, if an advisory opinion or a finding is controversial, what kind of feedback do you get? What recourse? I mean, I just really feel like there needs to be legislative oversight on this entire process. So I'm just concerned.
Okay. Mr. Sigurdsson, I have a question on your organization chart. It was my understanding that Mr. Goldsmith, he had retired, and I see that he's on a part-time basis. Is that a separate contract, or how is that being managed?
Hey, I'm sure. No. Mr. Goldsmith is a is part-time 0.6. He was no longer interested in the role of executive director. However, we were in a position where in our budget and in terms of work that we needed to have done, it was an advantage to the board to be able to have someone who is both an attorney at one point in his career. Mr. Goldsmith was a professional programmer and obviously has a lot of experience dealing with the state. to bring him on to continue to manage the website development as his primary project, and then be able to also, you know, assist me in my transition. It was an opportunity that we decided was the best interest of the board, and with the board's blessing, we have brought him in as a 0.6.
Okay, and so just so I'm clear in understanding that, so he did separate from the state, and now he was brought back as a 0.6 employee.
Yes, ma'am. He is a management analyst, so he is a MAIT classification. He's not an outside contractor, just to clarify.
Okay, great. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know we've got other business, but Mr. Gehring, when he was reading from the statute, I'm just going to ask if you can read that provision again, and then I'm going to ask a question so it's in everybody's front of their mind here.
Mr. Gehring.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, Section 10A.02, Sub 13 is the rulemaking subdivision for the board, and it says, I'm quoting here, the board may adopt rules to carry out the purposes of this chapter.
And Mr.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gehring, is there anything after that that would provide guidance to the board so that they know what's within the guidelines of enforcing their mission as charged by statute?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, the next paragraph is some required notices to the legislature about the rulemaking process, but there's no additional specification about what the purposes of the chapter are supposed to be.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gehring and Mr. Seegerson, this is not a getcha-gotcha question. Members, this is rulemaking in the legislature in every agency. Without any kind of guidelines or parameters on there, we can just all go home right now as the legislature, and then all the agencies can promulgate the rules. If we don't put guidelines in to say here's what you can and cannot do within that because of the separation of the branches of government, the executive, legislative, and judicial. And that's all I'm going to say about that today.
All right. Members, any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. Mr. Hubinger. Welcome to the committee, when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Thanks for the opportunity for us to talk about the joint legislative offices, within the legislative branch, and an overview of our budgets. I'm planning to provide a high-level overview of the joint offices, and then say a little bit about the Legislative Coordinating Commission and what it is and what it does, and then provide a high-level view of our budgets. The directors of the joint legislative offices are here. Don't be nervous. Not all the folks in our contingent are directors. You'll only be hearing from some of them. Some of them are lifelines for us in case you have detailed questions. I believe you have a packet with our materials in it. The first page is an organizational chart of sorts that shows all of the joint legislative offices and commissions. These have all been established in law by the legislature. I think you can imagine for the new members that you have the House on one side of this page and the Senate on the other. These other offices, these joint offices, have been established in law to provide support for the work that you do. The joint offices are on the left-hand side, the revisor of statutes, the reference library, and the legislative auditor. I'll be talking more about the Legislative Coordinating Commission that's on the right-hand side of the page. For the new members, a commission is sort of like a committee, except it's made up of members of both the House and the Senate. They're bipartisan in nature. Importantly, all of the staff that work for all of the joint offices are nonpartisan, and in that way, we are like the House Research and the House Fiscal Analysis staff. Talking about the Legislative Coordinating Commission, that is a 12-member group, six members from the House, six members from the Senate, and composed of leadership from both bodies. Its general function is to provide oversight and coordination of the joint legislative offices. I'm going to mention just a couple of the boxes on the right-hand side, just to highlight a couple of them. One is the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, which is in the bottom right, second from the bottom. That is a 10-member group, five representatives, five senators. It has been established to provide oversight and to provide interim approval of the labor contracts between the state the executive branch and its 50,000 employees. There are 13 labor contracts that cover about 90% of those 50,000 employees. Those contracts add up to about $8 billion for the biennium, and so the legislature has wanted to exercise cautious oversight of those contracts. The subcommittee can provide interim approval of those contracts, which are generally negotiated in the summer months, but then those contracts have to be ratified by the next session of the legislature. 12 of the 13 contracts were reviewed during the 16th session and given approval. There is one contract that went through an interest arbitration process and took longer. That will be submitted for ratification during the 17th session. In addition, the administration negotiated amendments to the other contracts providing for paid parenting leave. Those amendments will also be considered by the 17th session. A second group that I wanted to mention is the Regents Candidate Advisory Council. It's two boxes up from the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. This is a 24-member citizen group, 12 citizens appointed by the Speaker and 12 by the Senate. These 24 citizens have the responsibility to recruit and interview and then recommend candidates for the Board of Regents for the University of Minnesota. The board is elected by the legislature. The RCAC has done its interviewing work and has recommended 12 candidates for the four vacancies that will exist on July 1st. You will be meeting in joint convention later in February or early March to conduct that election. Besides providing support to these commissions and task forces, the LCC also has a number of administrative roles. We coordinate the budget development process for all of the other joint legislative offices. We provide and coordinate the development of benefits for staff across the legislature, as well as insurance benefits for members. We have a fiscal services office that provides accounting and payroll services for the joint offices. Whenever there's a bill legislation that has an impact on the legislature as an institution, our office prepares the fiscal note that calculates that impact. We work with House and Senate staff to do that. And then we contract for a number of services that support the work of the legislature. We contract for the phone service for the legislature, for the television broadcast, and for a number of accessibility services such as sign language interpreters and captioners. The next page in your handout is just a summary of the budgets for the commissions and joint offices. This is for the current biennium, FY 16 and 17. The top half is the general fund support for the joint offices. We show the 16 appropriation, the 16 spending, 17 appropriation, and then the spending year to date for 17. Our total appropriation for 17 is about $17.4 million. That's about 20% of the legislature's budget. While most of the funding for our offices is from the general fund, the bottom half shows the funding for some of the other groups, SANS, Environmental Trust Fund. Those budgets and commissions are reviewed in other committees. Because of the variety of program sources and funding sources, the LCC has about 45 different accounts within SWIFT within MMB. The next slide is an FTE chart for the joint offices. We show the history from 2009 through 2017. The middle is the permanent staff that we have, and the right-hand side shows the temporary staff. We have about 145 staff overall. It's an increase of about 10 over the last 8 years. Four of those were for the Lasard Sams Council that was established after the Legacy Amendment passed. There were three new positions in the Revisor's Office for critical IT support, and then there were a couple of additions in the Office of the Legislative Auditor. The Chair indicated interest in having details about our operating budgets. The next 15 pages of our packet are the Manager's financial reports that show our spending by object code. For the half of the pages are for FY16, the other half are for FY17 year to date. We'd be happy to answer any of those questions. That concludes my overview. The other directors are here to talk about their offices and their budgets.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hubinger. Members, any questions for Mr. Hubinger? We'll have each of the other individuals come forward. Okay. Oh, Representative Quam, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this the appropriate time to ask questions about items in this packet?
Yeah, that's fine, if you want.
Looking at, and this is labeled Joint Legislative Agencies and Legislative Commissions Budget Review Fiscal Year 16-17, looking at page 1, or not 1, page 3, the first row on revisor statutes, it shows the allotment for 16 and spending where it was down 10%. And then page 5 appears to have a larger breakdown, but the current budget and the expended don't match, and the delta there is 7.3%. And I'm trying to understand where the other $303,000 could be, visible at.
Mr. Hubinger, do you know where he's referring?
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I believe that spending for 16 for the revisor's office of $5,500,000 includes both the spending from their operating budget on page 5 and the IT support on page 6.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Drew. The numbers don't total up, so there's something else somewhere, but I guess I'm not surprised that the missing dollars were in IT.
Mr. Kissinger, any comment? Any comment, Mr. Hubert?
No, if there's a discrepancy, Madam Chair, we'll go back and check those numbers.
Okay, great. All right. And if you want to have the rest of your folks come forward. Perhaps the advisors can kind of help us out on that piece.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Paul Marinak. I'm the revisor of statutes. I have with me Mr. Tim Orr, who's the deputy for IT, Information Services, in our office. I became the revisor 2 months ago, so I'm new on the job. I want to be very respectful of your time today, so I'd like to talk about the issues that you think are important. If you think it might be useful to provide kind of just a general overview of the office, I'd be happy to take a couple minutes to do that.
Members, does anybody need to know what the revisor's office does? Okay. We're fully informed. We're a month in already, Scott.
Okay.
I think we're good. Members, do you have any questions about the revisor's piece of their budget at all? You are off the hook, Mr. Marinak.
I would like to make one point.
Please do.
And I'd like to draw your attention to one of the slides which shows the revisor's carry forward.
Okay.
And that would be... Bear with me here. Page 20. Now, about 10 years ago, the revisor was asked to respond to a concern with the way that the final budgets were put together and the peaks and valleys in certain items in the budget, principally IT. And that was because in some years we could look forward to the next biennium, anticipate quite a few expenses. In the next biennium, there may not be. And so in an attempt to even out those peaks and valleys, the revisor decided instead to try to keep those items in the budget relatively flat or increasing at a very modest rate. And through prudent management of the budget, try to maintain a carry-forward account that was sufficient to fund the known expenses, IT, 3, 6, 10 years out, because we know that these machines are relentless. They have to be replaced. There are software maintenance agreements that have to be done. So this was a way of trying to even that out. And so the revisor's carry-forward budget is used for those purposes. I just looked the other day, and I think in the next biennium we anticipate about $255,000 worth of planned expenses. There are also unforeseen expenses, and we want to make sure that we have a carry forward that is adequate to address a situation where there's a catastrophic failure, especially if it happens when you folks need to do your work. And so the reviser had decided that this was a prudent approach. So I just want to provide that context. We have been operating under that premise. If that were to change, obviously, the amounts that we would want allocated to the specific lines would obviously have to increase. But that is the principle that the reviser has followed in the past.
And, Mr. Marinak, when you set your carry forward, do you have a cap on it? And what did you base the amount needed on?
It's really in the reviser's judgment. We know what the known expenses would be. Mm-hmm. But it's the unknown expenses and the sort of catastrophic failures that we have to sort of, the reviser has to guess at. My predecessor did a really wonderful job in managing the state funds. She left me with an adequate amount to run the office and also engage in any of the planned initiatives we have. It's a budget that's sufficient to take care of all of the known issues that we come up with and to provide funding for the unknown. So I'm comfortable with the way the budget. I can tell you that if I were not told to decrease or increase my budget, I think we will be coming in with a budget recommendation that will ask for funding levels for the office that we had 16 years ago, 2001. So I think it will be a prudent budget. Obviously, if there are specific initiatives, we'll have to fund those also. You may be considering one of those specific initiatives last year. And in the budget, it's really not clear, but there's $380,000. That is not part of our operating budget. It was an appropriation that the legislature gave to us last year. Sort of in response to an initiative that Governor Dayton had, wanted to provide funding to the reviser to create, maintain, and preserve an electronic rulemaking record of all state agency rulemaking. So pursuant to this one-time appropriation, we're probably in the final stages of putting together a report for the legislature. We will present that report. It will not be part of our operating budget, but it's a significant initiative that should stand and fall on its merits. I will say, if you're interested in this, the reviser does have a beta system that we have pledged to maintain indefinitely that has a very extensive database of historical administrative rule documents. All of the critical rule documents until the beginning of time as we charted, which is 1980, can be accessed there. There are thousands of sonars, thousands of ALJ opinions, all the notices in the state register. And so we will maintain this database, but this initiative would be to take that core function and then expand it to the entire rulemaking record. And obviously, it would be much easier for individual legislators or legislative committees to get information. Right now, agencies are told to deliver a rulemaking docket and an entire rulemaking record to each committee. That's very difficult to work with. If we were able to build and maintain this system, you would be able to get in and look at those documents at any time. So that's the other initiative.
Well, and Mr. Marinak, this isn't just directed at you, but just overall and every entity that has a carry forward. Mm-hmm. What I'm looking for is that there is a cap on what that carry forward amount is, and that there has been a thought process on what would potentially be needed and to justify what that carry forward amount would be.
Yes.
And, you know, I understand that there is a need for having funds set aside for potential emergencies, disasters, who knows what could happen.
Yeah.
But I am concerned that we are having these carry forward accounts, and like I said, not just, you know, you, it's just sure. Overall, and that we have no rhyme or reason of why we have them in place.
Madam Chair, and you're right to be concerned about that. I have the luxury of having Mr. Orr here, who has managed the IT portion of the budget, where most of this comes from. He has very detailed information about our planned expenditures over the next 3, 6, 10 years. because that can be projected. How you arrive at the other portion of it, how much should we set aside for unexpected contingencies, that's much more difficult.
Maybe, but I think that, I mean, in any sector of this society, they do have a percentage that they work off of. So I think it would be helpful for us. This is something that we should probably look at is, you know, what is that right amount?
Exactly.
Realizing that there might be a time where you maybe don't just have enough, but that's where we're here, and we can provide that emergency need, address that emergency need when it would arise.
Yeah.
But I do think that we need to be conscious of how much we're setting aside and have it based on it's a percentage of X, Y, and Z, and so that when people ask, well, why is there such a flush amount of money here, we can say this is the thought process that went into, and it wasn't just kind of...
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what we were attempting to get at by doing this, being able to project costs. The other, there is a very rigid control, and state law regulates what we can spend carry forward on, and certainly this process is a method of making sure that the judgments we've made carry forward are consistent with your wishes. The other thing that I'd suggest, a tool that I have asked for, is for the LCC to recreate a revisor subcommittee. It was a very effective tool for us to have these sorts of discussions, not only budget discussions, but discussions with members to make sure we're doing what you want us to do. So that's one of the things that I have asked leadership to do, and I think perhaps that might be a vehicle too.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. I would like you to schedule some time, and we can sit down and kind of talk about the nitty-gritty
details.
So we are running short on time. Who do we have next? Mr. Knowles, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Knowles. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Madam Chair, time is short, but I did want to take just a few minutes to give a very brief overview of the functions and responsibilities of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, if that's okay. I'd be happy to come back later as well if we run out of time.
You know what? We're going to have you probably come before our committee a couple of different times, so let's try and cover that at that point.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Sure.
I do want to see if any members first have any questions for Mr. Knowles based on the budget side of things at all. And if not, I'd like you to hold, and if we can get the other two folks before us, and then if we have time, we'll have you come back and do this review, if you don't mind.
We'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair.
Again, I think most of us understand what you do, except for maybe a few of the freshman members, but you'll be before our committee several times, and I think they'll get a good flavor of what you do at that point as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And Ms. Lincoln.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Lincoln, the director of the Legislative Reference Library, and I will, I know time is very short, and I will distribute to each of you a little overview of the library that I have prepared. Just very briefly, we have 13.75 full-time equivalent in 15 positions. Our main tasks are to answer reference questions, archive, and collect the state agency publications and any public policy materials that assist the legislature with their research needs. If we don't serve you, we probably serve your staff. Just about our budget this year, obviously staff is our main expense. Supplies include books and a lot of periodicals. The biggest news this year is that we opened a small reading room in the Senate building. That affected our budget a little bit. The cost for those materials is about $5,000 a year. So that's just very quick what's happened, and I will get materials to each of you.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions for me?
It's a little treasure up there, so I usually don't tell anybody about it because I want to keep it to myself. Sorry. Any questions for Ms. Lincoln? If not, Ms. Lencheski.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Susan Lencheski, and I am the executive director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. I don't know how much time you want for me to take here to explain what we do. I guess I'll focus on kind of the budget here. There's really two components to our budget. One is salaries. We have three full-time employees, two of whom are attorneys, myself, the executive director, and the deputy director, and then a commission assistant. And then the second component of our budget is our contract with an outside actuary who provides services to the commission and helps us with oversight of the pension plans and the actuarial work that's being done by their actuaries for those plans. That's very briefly our budget. There's some miscellaneous items in there for employee development and that sort of thing, but the primary components are salary and actuary.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lincheski, at one time your office had 3.5 FTEs, and you are now down to 3 FTEs. Did I understand that correctly?
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, that is true. Actually, about 2 months or so before I arrived in August of 2015, there was a part-time staff person. She left employment in the summer of 2015, and we have not found the need to replace her or put someone in that position.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll? All right. Any other questions, members? Great. Thank you both. Appreciate it. Mr. Nobles, you've got 3 minutes. Highlights for us, Mr. Nobles?
Madam Chair, first of all, I would just say we feel a really strong connection with this committee. The Office of the Legislative Auditor was born here back in 1973 when the legislature decided that you wanted more tools for doing legislative oversight. You do a wonderful job in these committees, but I think you know from your experience, vast experience, that sometimes you leave here with a lot of questions unanswered, or at least you'd like to go a little deeper. And so the legislature set up the Office of the Legislative Auditor, just like the Congress has the Government Accountability Office, to dig deep into the details of what's going on in state government and bring back reports. And that's what we do. We do financial audits. We audit the state's financial statements. We also go in and do supplementary control compliance audits. And then we do evaluations at your request, about 6 or 8 of those every year, and we'll soon be asking you for ideas. And, Madam Chair, I really hope this committee will be a source of suggestions. I already have on the list to do an evaluation of Minute. I think it's time to do that after the consolidation to really dig deep and see what we actually are accomplishing in terms of cost savings, but also in the delivery of service as well. So any other ideas that you may have, please bring them to us. We also do special reviews from time to time. Sometimes they're called investigations. And you may be aware of the fact that we are currently conducting a special review and investigation of the controversy that arose about the use of suites by the public officials who controlled the U.S. Bank Stadium. And we will be releasing that report to this committee and with your counterpart in the Senate on the 7th, I believe, Madam Chair, is what has been set for that. So, again, we have the authority to pursue those at the initiative of the legislative auditor, and that one I pursued the minute I saw the newspaper article about the what I consider to be a very questionable use of the prerogatives of public officials. But we also certainly take suggestions from you. We did get a suggestion from this committee back in 2015 that I am still working on, and I have apologized to the chair and Mr. Cook a number of times that other projects have taken me away from that assignment, but that will be here for you as well. So, Madam Chair, I think I used up the time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Driscoll.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, would scoping out rulemaking be something that you're, you would seem to be able to be within the purview of something you'd be able to do?
Say that again?
Scoping out the use and implementation by agencies of rulemaking?
Well, Representative O'Driscoll, I think you and I should have a conversation. So,
Madam Chair, you're notifying me.
I would just respond that I started my career in the legislature sitting on the other side of the table with this committee as the staff. And I was just telling legal counsel for OLA that the first committee hearing I attended, and I won't tell you how many years ago that was, but it was a long time ago, it was about the usurpation of legislative prerogatives by administrative agencies in rulemaking. So it's been a long-standing concern,
We tried in the amendment to the Administrative Procedures Act in 1975 to really tighten up the process. But I think it really is a very legitimate ongoing concern that the legislature ought to have because, as was mentioned, once promulgated, they have the force and effect of law, and they affect every one of your constituents in a very meaningful way and undoubtedly affect you as a citizen as well. So,
Mr. Nobles, I'm not sure if that gives me peace of mind or it makes me more concerned. Representative Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, I realize that Mr. Nobles didn't want to tell us the year that he was here, but he may want to share who was governor at the time. So you do, I think, have those portraits going back into the Capitol as of this morning. So,
excellent. Members, any other questions?
We look forward to being back with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Hubinger, Mr. Nobles, everyone else. Appreciate your time. With that, members, just some housekeeping things. So next week, next Thursday, we will not have state government finance, but we will have it Tuesday and Wednesday. So hopefully that changes some things for your schedule. So just remember, next Thursday, we will not have state government finance. Mr. Holtquist will send that out, so you will have that information available to you too. Okay? With that, we are adjourned.